This is Michelle Alexander's The New Jim Crow. This is the first of two parts of Chapter 5, which is also called The New Jim Crow. It was no ordinary Sunday morning when presidential candidate Barack Obama stepped to the podium at the Apostolic Church of God in Chicago. It was Father's Day. Hundreds of enthusiastic congregants packed the pews at the overwhelmingly black church, eager to hear what the first black Democratic nominee for president of the United States had to say. The message was a familiar one. Black men should be better fathers. Too many are absent from their homes. For those in the audience, Obama's speech was an old tune sung by an exciting new performer. His message of personal responsibility, particularly as it relates to fatherhood, was anything but new. It had been delivered countless times by black ministers and churches across America. The message had also been delivered on a national stage by celebrities such as Bill Cosby and Sidney Poitier. And the message had been delivered with great passion by Louis Farrakhan, who more than a decade earlier summoned 1 million black men to Washington, D.C. for a day of atonement and recommitment to their families and communities. The mainstream media, however, treated the event as big news, and many pundits seemed surprised that the black congregants actually applauded the message. For them, it was remarkable that black people nodded in approval when Obama said, "If we're honest with ourselves, we'll admit that too many fathers are missing. Missing from too many lives and too many homes. Too many fathers are MIA. Too many fathers are AWOL. They've abandoned their responsibilities. They're acting like boys instead of men. And the foundations of our families are weaker because of it. You and I know this is true everywhere, but nowhere is it more true than in the African-American community." The media did not ask, and Obama did not tell, where the missing fathers might be found. The following day, social critic and sociologist Michael Eric Dyson published a critique of Obama's speech in Time magazine. He pointed out that the stereotype of black men being poor fathers may well be false. Research by Boston College social psychologist Rebecca Levine Coley found that black fathers not living at home are more likely to keep in contact with their children than fathers of any other ethnic or racial group. Dyson chided Obama for evoking a black stereotype for political gain, pointing out that Obama's words may have been spoken to black folk, but they were aimed at those whites still on the fence about whom to send to the White House. Dyson's critique was a fair one, but like other media commentators, he remained silent about where all the absent black fathers could be found. He identified numerous social problems plaguing black families, such as high levels of unemployment, discriminatory mortgage practices, and the gutting of early childhood learning programs. Not a word was said about prisons. The public discourse regarding missing black fathers closely parallels the debate about the lack of eligible black men for marriage. The majority of black women are unmarried today, including 70% of professional black women. "Where have all the black men gone?" is a common refrain heard among black women frustrated in their efforts to find life partners. The sense that black men have disappeared is rooted in reality. The U.S. Census Bureau reported in 2002 that there are nearly 3 million more black adult women than men in black communities across the United States, a gender gap of 26%. In many urban areas, the gap is far worse, rising to more than 37% in places like New York City. The comparable disparity for whites in the United States is 8%. Although 1 million black men can be found in prisons and jails, public acknowledgement of the role of the criminal justice system in disappearing black men is surprisingly rare. Even in the black media, which is generally more willing to raise and tackle issues related to criminal justice, an eerie silence can often be found. Ebony magazine, for example, ran an article in December 2006 entitled, "Where Have the Black Men Gone?" The author posed the popular question but never answered it. He suggested we will find our black men when we rediscover God, family, and self-respect. A more cynical approach was taken by Tyra Banks, the popular talk show host, who devoted a show in May 2008 to the recurring question, "Where have all the good black men gone?" She wondered aloud whether black women are unable to find good black men because too many of them are gay or dating white women. No mention was made of the war on drugs or mass incarceration. The fact that Barack Obama can give a speech on Father's Day dedicated to the subject of fathers who are AWOL without ever acknowledging that the majority of young black men in large urban areas are currently under the control of the criminal justice system is disturbing, to say the least. What is more problematic, though, is that hardly anyone in the mainstream media noticed the oversight. One might not expect serious analysis from Tyra Banks, but shouldn't we expect a bit more from the New York Times and CNN? Hundreds of thousands of black men are unable to be good fathers for their children, not because of a lack of commitment or desire, but because they are warehoused in prisons, locked in cages. They did not walk out on their families voluntarily. They were taken away in handcuffs, often due to a massive federal program known as the War on Drugs. More African Americans are under correctional control today, in prison or jail, on probation or parole, than were enslaved in 1850, a decade before the Civil War began. The mass incarceration of people of color is a big part of the reason that a black child born today is less likely to be raised by both parents than a black child born during slavery. The absence of black fathers from families across America is not simply a function of laziness, immaturity, or too much time watching SportsCenter. Thousands of black men have disappeared into prisons and jails, locked away for drug crimes that are largely ignored when committed by whites. The clock has been turned back on racial progress in America, though scarcely anyone seems to notice. All eyes are fixed on people like Barack Obama and Oprah Winfrey, who have defied the odds and risen to power, fame, and fortune. For those left behind, especially those within prison walls, the celebration of racial triumph in America must seem a tad premature. More black men are imprisoned today than at any other moment in our nation's history. More disenfranchised today than in 1870, the year the 15th Amendment was ratified, prohibiting laws that explicitly deny the right to vote on the basis of race. Young black men today may be just as likely to suffer discrimination in employment, housing, public benefits, and jury service as a black man in the Jim Crow era, discrimination that is perfectly legal because it's based on one's criminal record. This is the new normal, the new racial equilibrium. The launching of the war on drugs and the initial construction of the new system required the expenditure of tremendous political initiative and resources. Media campaigns were waged, politicians blasted soft judges and enacted harsh sentencing laws. Poor people of color were vilified. The system now, however, requires very little maintenance or justification. In fact, if you're white and middle class, you might not even realize the drug war is still going on. Most high school and college students today have no recollection of the political and media frenzy surrounding the drug war in the early years. They were young children when the war was declared, or not even born yet. Crack is out, terrorism is in. Today, the political fanfare and the vehement racialized rhetoric regarding crime and drugs are no longer necessary. Mass incarceration has been normalized, and all of the racial stereotypes and assumptions that gave rise to the system are now embraced, or at least internalized, by people of all colors, from all walks of life, and in every major political party. We may wonder aloud, where have all the black men gone, but deep down we already know. It is simply taken for granted that, in cities like Baltimore and Chicago, the vast majority of young black men are currently under the control of the criminal justice system, or branded criminals for life. This extraordinary circumstance, unheard of in the rest of the world, is treated here in America as a basic fact of life, as normal as separate water fountains were just half a century ago. States of denial. The claim that we really know where all the black men have gone may inspire considerable doubt. If we know, why do we feign ignorance? Could it be that most people really don't know? Is it possible that the roundup, lockdown, and exclusion of black men en masse from the body politic has occurred largely unnoticed? The answer is yes and no. Much has been written about the ways in which people manage to deny, even to themselves, that extraordinary atrocities, racial oppression, and other forms of human suffering have occurred or are occurring. Criminologist Stanley Cohen wrote perhaps the most important book on the subject, States of Denial. The book examines how individuals and institutions, victims, perpetrators, and bystanders, know about yet deny the occurrence of oppressive acts. They see only what they want to see and wear blinders to avoid seeing the rest. This has been true about slavery, genocide, torture, and every form of systemic oppression. Cohen emphasizes that denial, though deplorable, is complicated. It is not simply a matter of refusing to acknowledge an obvious, though uncomfortable, truth. Many people know and not know the truth about human suffering at the same time. In his words, denial may be neither a matter of telling the truth nor intentionally telling a lie. There seem to be states of mind, or even whole cultures, in which we know and don't know at the same time. Today, most Americans know and don't know the truth about mass incarceration. For more than 3 decades, images of black men in handcuffs have been a regular staple of the evening news. We know that large numbers of black men have been locked in cages. In fact, it is precisely because we know that black and brown people are far more likely to be imprisoned that we as a nation have not cared too much about it. We tell ourselves they deserve their fate, even though we know, and don't know, that whites are just as likely to commit many crimes, especially drug crimes. We know that people released from prison face a lifetime of discrimination, scorn, and exclusion. Yet, we claim not to know that an undercaste exists. We know and we don't know at the same time. Upon reflection, it is relatively easy to understand how Americans come to deny the evils of mass incarceration. Denial is facilitated by a persistent racial segregation in housing and schools, by political demagoguery, by racialized media imagery, and by the ease of changing one's perception of reality simply by changing television channels. There's little reason to doubt that the prevailing common sense that black and brown men have been locked up en masse merely in response to crime rates when one's sources of information are mainstream media outlets. In many respects, the reality of mass incarceration is easier to avoid knowing than the injustices and sufferings associated with slavery or Jim Crow. Those confined to prisons are out of sight and out of mind. Once released, they're typically confined in ghettos. Most Americans only come to know about people cycling in and out of prisons through fictional police dramas, music videos, gangsta rap, and true accounts of ghetto experience on the evening news. These racialized narratives tend to confirm and reinforce the prevailing public consensus that we need not care about those people. They deserve what they get. Of all the reasons that we fail to know the truth about mass incarceration, though, one stands out. A profound misunderstanding regarding how racial oppression actually works. If someone were to visit the United States from another country or another planet and ask, is the U.S. criminal justice system some kind of tool of racial control? Most Americans would swiftly deny it. Numerous reasons would leap to mind why that could not possibly be the case. The visitor could be told that crime rates, black culture, or bad schools were to blame. The system is not run by a bunch of racists, the apologist would explain. It's run by people who are trying to fight crime. That response is predictable, because most people assume that racism and racial systems generally are fundamentally a function of attitudes. Because mass incarceration is officially colorblind, it seems inconceivable that the system could function much like a racial caste system. The widespread and mistaken belief that racial animus is necessary for the creation and maintenance of racialized systems of control is the most important reason that we as a nation have remained in deep denial. The misunderstanding is not surprising. As a society, our collective understanding of racism has been powerfully influenced by the shocking images of the Jim Crow era and the struggle for civil rights. When we think of racism, we think of Governor Wallace of Alabama blocking the schoolhouse door. We think of water hoses, lynchings, racial epithets, and whites-only signs. These images make it easy to forget that many wonderful, good-hearted white people who were generous to others, respectful of their neighbors, and even kind to their black maids, gardeners, or shoe shiners, and wished them well, nevertheless went to the polls and voted for racial segregation. Many whites who supported Jim Crow justified it on paternalist grounds, actually believing that they were doing blacks a favor, or believing the time was not yet right for equality. The disturbing images from the Jim Crow era also make it easy to forget that many African Americans were complicit in the Jim Crow system, profiting from it directly or indirectly, or keeping their objections quiet out of fear of the repercussions. Our understanding of racism is therefore shaped by the most extreme expressions of individual bigotry, not by the way in which it functions naturally, almost invisibly, and sometimes with genuinely benign intent, when it is embedded in the structure of a social system. The unfortunate reality we must face is that racism manifests itself not only in individual attitudes and stereotypes, but also in the basic structure of society. Academics have developed complicated theories and obscure jargon in an effort to describe what is now referred to as structural racism. Yet, the concept is fairly straightforward. One theorist, Iris Marion Young, relying on a famous birdcage metaphor, explains it this way. If one thinks about racism by examining only one wire of the cage, or one form of disadvantage, it's difficult to understand how and why the bird is trapped. Only a large number of wires, arranged in a specific way and connected to one another, serve to enclose the bird and ensure that it cannot escape. What is particularly important to keep in mind is that any given wire of the cage may or may not be specifically developed for the purpose of trapping the bird, yet it still operates, together with the other wires, to restrict its freedom. By the same token, not every aspect of a racial caste system needs to be developed for the specific purpose of controlling black people in order for it to operate, together with other laws, institutions, and practices, to trap them at the bottom of a racial hierarchy. In the system of mass incarceration, a wide variety of laws, institutions, and practices, ranging from racial profiling to biased sentencing policies, political disenfranchisement, and legalized employment discrimination, trap African Americans in a virtual and literal cage. Fortunately, as Marilyn Fry has noted, every birdcage has a door, and every birdcage can be broken and can corrode. What is most concerning about the new racial caste system, however, is that it may prove to be more durable than its predecessors. Because this new system is not explicitly based on race, it's easier to defend on seemingly neutral grounds. And while all previous methods of control have blamed the victim in one way or another, the current system invites observers to imagine that those who are trapped in the system were free to avoid second-class status or permanent banishment from society simply by choosing not to commit crimes. It is far more convenient to imagine that a majority of young African-American men in urban areas freely chose a life of crime than to accept the real possibility that their lives were structured in a way that virtually guaranteed their early admission into a system from which they can never escape. Most people are willing to acknowledge the existence of the cage, but insist that a door has been left open. One way of understanding our current system of mass incarceration is to think of it as a birdcage with a locked door. It is a set of structural arrangements that locks a racially distinct group into a subordinate political, social, and economic position, effectively creating a second-class citizenship. Those trapped within the system are not merely disadvantaged in the sense that they are competing on an unequal playing field or face additional hurdles to political or economic success. Rather, the system itself is structured to lock them into a subordinate position. How it works. Precisely how the system of mass incarceration works to trap African Americans in a virtual and literal cage can best be understood by viewing the system as a whole. In earlier chapters, we considered various wires of the cage in isolation. Here we put the pieces together, step back, and view the cage in its entirety. Only when we view the cage from a distance can we disengage from the maze of rationalizations that are offered for each wire and see how the entire apparatus operates to keep African Americans perpetually trapped. This, in brief, is how the system works. The war on drugs is the vehicle through which extraordinary numbers of black men are forced into the cage. The entrapment occurs in three distinct phases, each of which has been explored earlier, but a brief review is useful here. The first stage is the roundup. Vast numbers of people are swept into the criminal justice system by the police, who conduct drug operations primarily in poor communities of color. They are rewarded in cash through drug forfeiture laws and federal grant programs for rounding up as many people as possible, and they operate unconstrained by constitutional rules of procedure that once were considered inviolate. Police can stop, interrogate, and search anyone they choose for drug investigations, provided they get consent. Because there is no meaningful check on the exercise of police discretion, racial biases are granted free rein. In fact, police are allowed to rely on race as a factor in selecting whom to stop and search, even though people of color are no more likely to be guilty of drug crimes than whites, effectively guaranteeing that those who are swept into the system are primarily black and brown. The conviction marks the beginning of the second phase, the period of formal control. Once arrested, defendants are generally denied meaningful legal representation and pressured to plead guilty, whether they are or not. Prosecutors are free to load up defendants with extra charges, and their decisions cannot be challenged for racial bias. Once convicted, due to the drug war's harsh sentencing laws, drug offenders in the United States spend more time under the criminal justice system's formal control, in jail or prison, on probation or parole, than drug offenders anywhere else in the world. While under formal control, virtually every aspect of one's life is regulated and monitored by the system, and any form of resistance or disobedience is subject to swift sanction. This period of control may last a lifetime, even for those convicted of extremely minor nonviolent offenses, but the vast majority of those swept into the system are eventually released. They are transferred from their prison cells to a much larger invisible cage. The final stage has been dubbed by some advocates as the period of invisible punishment. This term, first coined by Jeremy Travis, is meant to describe the unique set of criminal sanctions that are imposed on individuals after they step outside the prison gates, a form of punishment that operates largely outside the public view and takes effect outside the traditional sentencing framework. These sanctions are imposed by operation of law rather than decisions of a sentencing judge, yet they often have a greater impact on one's life course than the months or years one actually spends behind bars. These laws operate collectively to ensure that the vast majority of convicted offenders will never integrate into mainstream white society. They will be discriminated against legally for the rest of their lives, denied employment, housing, education, and public benefits. Unable to surmount these obstacles, most will eventually return to prison and then be released again, caught in a closed circuit of perpetual marginality. In recent years, advocates and politicians have called for greater resources devoted to the problem of prisoner re-entry, in view of the unprecedented number of people who are released from prison and returned to their communities every year. While the terminology is well-intentioned, it utterly fails to convey the gravity of the situation facing prisoners upon their release. People who have been convicted of felonies almost never truly re-enter the society they inhabited prior to their conviction. Instead, they enter a separate society, a world hidden from public view, governed by a set of oppressive and discriminatory rules and laws that do not apply to everyone else. They become members of an undercaste, an enormous population of predominantly black and brown people who, because of the drug war, are denied basic rights and privileges of American citizenship, and are permanently relegated to an inferior status. This is the final phase, and there's no going back. Nothing new? Some might argue that, as disturbing as this system appears to be, there's nothing particularly new about mass incarceration. It is merely a continuation of past drug wars and biased law enforcement practices. Racial bias in our criminal justice system is simply an old problem that's gotten worse, and the social excommunication of criminals has a long history. It's not a recent invention. There's some merit to this argument. Race has always influenced the administration of justice in the United States. Since the day the first prison opened, people of color have been disproportionately represented behind bars. In fact, the very first person admitted to a U.S. penitentiary was a light-skinned Negro in excellent health, described by an observer as one who was born of a degraded and depressed race, and had never experienced anything but indifference and harshness. Biased police practices are also nothing new, a recurring theme of African-American experience since blacks were targeted by police as suspected runaway slaves. And every drug war that has ever been waged in the United States, including alcohol prohibition, has been tainted or driven by racial bias. Even post-conviction penalties have a long history. The American colonies passed laws barring criminal offenders from a wide variety of jobs and benefits, automatically dissolving their marriages and denying them right to enter contracts. These legislatures were following a long tradition, dating back to ancient Greece, of treating criminals as less than full citizens. Although many collateral sanctions were repealed by the late 1970s, arguably the drug war simply revived and expanded a tradition that has ancient roots, a tradition independent of the legacy of American slavery. In view of this history, and considering the lack of originality in many of the tactics and practices employed in the era of mass incarceration, there's good reason to believe that the latest drug war is just another drug war corrupted by racial and ethnic bias. But this view is correct only to a point. In the past, the criminal justice system, as punitive as it may have been during various wars on crime and drugs, affected only a relatively small percentage of the population. Because civil penalties and sanctions imposed on ex-offenders applied only to a few, they never operated as a comprehensive system of control over any racial or ethnically defined population. Racial minorities were always overrepresented among current and ex-offenders, but as sociologists have noted, until the mid-1980s, the criminal justice system was marginal to communities of color. While young minority men with little schooling have always had relatively high rates of incarceration, before the 1980s, the penal system was not a dominant presence in the disadvantaged neighborhoods. Today, the war on drugs has given birth to a system of mass incarceration that governs not just a small fraction of a racial or ethnic minority, but entire communities of color. In ghetto communities, nearly everyone is either directly or indirectly subject to the new caste system. The system serves to redefine the terms of the relationship of poor people of color and their communities to mainstream white society, ensuring their subordinate and marginal status. The criminal and civil sanctions that were once reserved for a tiny minority are now used to control and oppress a racially defined majority in many communities, and the systematic manner in which the control is achieved reflects not just a difference in scale, the nature of the criminal justice system has changed. It's no longer concerned primarily with the prevention and punishment of crime, but rather with the management and control of the dispossessed. Prior drug wars were ancillary to the prevailing caste system. This time, the drug war is the system of control. If you doubt that this is the case, consider the effect of the war on the ground, in specific locales. Take Chicago, Illinois, for example. Chicago is widely considered to be one of America's most diverse and vibrant cities. It has boasted black mayors, black police chiefs, black legislators, and is home to the nation's first black president. It has a thriving economy, a growing Latino community, and a substantial black middle class. Yet, as the Chicago Urban League reported in 2002, there's another story to be told. If Martin Luther King Jr. were to return miraculously to Chicago, some 40 years after bringing his freedom movement to the city, he would be saddened to discover that the same issues on which he originally focused still produce stark patterns of racial inequality, segregation, and poverty. He would also be struck by the dramatically elevated significance of one particular institutional force in the perpetuation and deepening of those patterns, the criminal justice system. In the few short decades since King's death, a new regime of racially disparate mass incarceration has emerged in Chicago and become the primary mechanism for racial oppression and the denial of equal opportunity. In Chicago, like the rest of the country, the war on drugs is the engine of mass incarceration, as well as the primary cause of gross racial disparities in a criminal justice system and in the ex-offender population. About 90% of those sentenced to prison for a drug offense in Illinois are African American. White drug offenders are rarely arrested, and when they are, they're treated more favorably at every stage of the criminal justice process, including plea bargaining and sentencing. Whites are consistently more likely to avoid prison and felony charges, even when they are repeat offenders. Black offenders, by contrast, are routinely labeled felons and released into a permanent racial undercast. The total population of black males in Chicago with a felony record, including both current and ex-felons, is equivalent to 55% of the black adult male population and an astonishing 80% of the adult black male workforce in the Chicago area. This stunning development reflects the dramatic increase in the number and race of those sent to prison for drug crimes. From the Chicago region alone, the number of those annually sent to prison for drug crimes increased almost 2,000% from 469 in 1985 to 8,755 in 2005. When people are released from Illinois prisons, they're given as little as $10 in gate money and a bus ticket to anywhere in the United States. Most return to impoverished neighborhoods in the Chicago area, bringing few resources and bearing the stigma of their prison label. In Chicago, as in most cities across the country, ex-offenders are banned or severely restricted from employment in a large number of professions, job categories, and fields by professional licensing statutes, rules, and practices that discriminate against potential employees with felony records. According to a study conducted by the DePaul University College of Law in 2000, of the then 98 occupations requiring licenses in Illinois, 57 placed stipulations and/or restrictions on applicants with a criminal record. Even when not barred by law from holding specific jobs, ex-offenders in Chicago find it extraordinarily difficult to find employers who will hire them, regardless of the nature of their conviction. They are also routinely denied public housing and welfare benefits, and they find it increasingly difficult to obtain education, especially now that funding for public education has been hard hit due to exploding prison budgets. The impact of the new caste system is most tragically felt among the young. In Chicago, as in other cities across the United States, young black men are more likely to go to prison than to college. As of June 2001, there were nearly 20,000 more black men in the Illinois state prison system than enrolled in the state's public universities. In fact, there were more black men in the state's correctional facilities that year, just on drug charges, than the total number of black men enrolled in undergraduate degree programs in state universities. To put the crisis in even sharper focus, consider this. Just 992 black men received a bachelor's degree from Illinois State Universities in 1999, while roughly 7,000 black men were released from the state prison system the following year, just for drug offenses. The young men who go to prison rather than a college face a lifetime of closed doors, discrimination, and ostracism. Their plight is not what we hear about on the evening news, however. Sadly, like the racial caste systems that preceded it, the system of mass incarceration now seems normal and natural to most, a regrettable necessity. Mapping the parallels. Those cycling in and out of Illinois prisons today are members of America's new racial undercast. The United States has almost always had a racial undercast, a group defined wholly or largely by race that is permanently locked out of mainstream white society by law, custom, and practice. The reasons and justifications change over time as each new caste system reflects and adapts to changes in the social, political, and economic context. What is most striking about the design of the current caste system, though, is how closely it resembles its predecessor. There are important differences between mass incarceration and Jim Crow, to be sure, many of which will be discussed later, but when we step back and view the system as a whole, there is a profound sense of déjà vu. There's a familiar stigma and shame. There's an elaborate system of control, complete with political disenfranchisement and legalized discrimination in every major realm of economic and social life. And there's the production of racial meaning and racial boundaries. Many of these parallels have been discussed at some length in earlier chapters. Others have yet to be explored. Listed below are several of the most obvious similarities between Jim Crow and mass incarceration, followed by a discussion of a few parallels that have not been discussed so far. Let's begin with the historical parallels. Historical parallels. Jim Crow and mass incarceration have similar political origins. As described in Chapter 1, both caste systems were born in part due to a desire among white elites to exploit the resentments, vulnerabilities, and racial biases of poor and working class whites for political or economic gain. Segregation laws were proposed as part of a deliberate and strategic effort to deflect anger and hostility that had been brewing against the white elite away from them and toward African Americans. The birth of mass incarceration can be traced to a similar political dynamic. Conservatives in the 1970s and 1980s sought to appeal to the racial biases and economic vulnerabilities of poor and working class whites through racially coded rhetoric on crime and welfare. In both cases, the racial opportunists offered few, if any, economic reforms to address the legitimate economic anxieties of poor and working class whites, proposing instead a crackdown on the racially defined others. In the early years of Jim Crow, conservative white elites competed with each other by passing ever more stringent oppressive Jim Crow legislation. A century later, politicians in the early years of the drug war competed with each other to prove who could be tougher on crime by passing ever harsher drug laws, a thinly veiled effort to appeal to poor and working class whites who, once again, proved they were willing to forego economic and structural reform in exchange for an apparent effort to put blacks back in their place. Legalized discrimination. The most obvious parallel between Jim Crow and mass incarceration is legalized discrimination. During Black History Month, Americans congratulate themselves for having put an end to discrimination against African Americans in employment, housing, public benefits, and public accommodations. School children wonder out loud how discrimination could ever have been legal in this great land of ours. Rarely are they told that it is still legal. Many of the forms of discrimination that relegated African Americans to an inferior caste during Jim Crow continue to apply to huge segments of the black population today, provided they are first labeled felons. If they're branded felons by the time they reach the age of 21, as many of them are, they're subject to legalized discrimination for their entire adult lives. The forms of discrimination that apply to ex-drug offenders, described in some detail in Chapter 4, mean that once prisoners are released, they enter a parallel social universe, much like Jim Crow, in which discrimination in nearly every aspect of social, political, and economic life is perfectly legal. Large majorities of black men in cities across the United States are once again subject to legalized discrimination, effectively barring them from full integration into mainstream white society. Mass incarceration has nullified many of the gains of the civil rights movement, putting millions of black men back in a position reminiscent of Jim Crow. Political disenfranchisement. During the Jim Crow era, African Americans were denied the right to vote through poll taxes, literacy tests, grandfather clauses, and felon disenfranchisement laws, even though the 15th Amendment to the U.S. Constitution specifically provides that the right of citizens of the United States to vote shall not be denied on account of race, color, or previous condition of servitude. Formally race-neutral devices were adopted to achieve the goal of an all-white electorate without violating the terms of the 15th Amendment. These devices worked quite well. Because African Americans were poor, they frequently could not pay poll taxes, and because they had been denied access to education, they could not pass literacy tests. Grandfather clauses allowed whites to vote even if they couldn't meet the requirements, as long as their ancestors had been able to vote. Finally, because blacks were disproportionately charged with felonies, in fact, some crimes were specifically defined as felonies with the goal of eliminating blacks from the electorate, felony disenfranchisement laws effectively suppressed the black vote as well. Following the collapse of Jim Crow, all of the race-neutral devices for excluding blacks from the electorate were eliminated through litigation or legislation, except felon disenfranchisement laws. Some courts have found that these laws have lost their discriminatory taint because they've been amended since the collapse of Jim Crow. Other courts have allowed the laws to stand because overt racial bias is absent from the legislative record. The failure of our legal system to eradicate all of the tactics adopted during the Jim Crow era to suppress the black vote has major implications today. Felon disenfranchisement laws have been more effective in eliminating black voters in the age of mass incarceration than they were during Jim Crow. Less than 2 decades after the war on drugs began, 1 in 7 black men nationally had lost the right to vote, and as many as 1 in 4 in those states with the highest African-American disenfranchisement rate. These figures may understate the impact of felony disenfranchisement because they do not take into account the millions of ex-felons who cannot vote in states that require ex-felons to pay fines or fees before their voting rights can be restored, the new poll tax. As legal scholar Pamela Carlin has observed, felony disenfranchisement has decimated the potential black electorate. It is worthy of note, however, that the exclusion of black voters from polling booths is not the only way in which black political power has been suppressed. Another dimension of disenfranchisement echoes not so much Jim Crow as slavery. Under the usual residence rule, the Census Bureau counts imprisoned individuals as residents of the jurisdiction in which they are incarcerated. Because most new prison construction occurs in predominantly white rural areas, white communities benefit from inflated population totals at the expense of the urban, overwhelmingly minority communities from which the prisoners came. This has enormous consequences for the redistricting process. White rural communities that house prisons wind up with more people in state legislatures representing them, while poor communities of color lose representatives because it appears their population has declined. This policy is disturbingly reminiscent of the 3/5 clause in the original Constitution, which enhanced the political clout of slaveholding states by including 60% of slaves in the population base for calculating congressional seats and electoral votes, even though they could not vote. Exclusion from juries. Another clear parallel between mass incarceration and Jim Crow is the systematic exclusion of blacks from juries. One hallmark of the Jim Crow era was all-white juries trying black defendants in the South. Although the exclusion of jurors on the basis of race has been illegal since 1880, as a practical matter, the removal of prospective black jurors through the race-based peremptory strikes was sanctioned by the Supreme Court until 1985, when the court ruled in Baston v. Kentucky that racially biased strikes violate the Equal Protection Clause of the 14th Amendment. Today, defendants face a situation highly similar to the one they faced a century ago. As described in Chapter 3, a formal prohibition against race-based peremptory strikes does exist, as a practical matter. However, the court has tolerated the systematic exclusion of blacks from juries by allowing lower courts to accept silly or even superstitious reasons for striking black jurors. To make matters worse, a large percentage of black men, about 30%, are automatically excluded from jury service because they have been labeled felons. The combined effect of race-based peremptory strikes and the automatic exclusion of felons from juries has put black defendants in a familiar place, in a courtroom in shackles, facing an all-white jury. Closing the courthouse doors. The parallels between mass incarceration and Jim Crow extend all the way to the U.S. Supreme Court. Over the years, the Supreme Court has followed a fairly consistent pattern in responding to racial caste systems, first protecting them and then, after dramatic shifts in the political and social climate, dismantling these systems of control and some of their vestiges. In Dred Scott v. Sanford, the Supreme Court immunized the institution of slavery from legal challenge on the grounds that African Americans were not citizens, and in Plessy v. Ferguson, the court established the doctrine of separate but equal, a legal fiction that protected the Jim Crow system from judicial scrutiny for racial bias. Currently, McCleskey v. Kemp and its progeny serve much the same function as Dred Scott and Plessy. In McCleskey, the Supreme Court demonstrated that it is once again in protection mode, firmly committed to the prevailing system of control.
As Chapter 3 demonstrated, the court has closed the courthouse doors to claims of racial bias at every stage of the criminal justice process, from stops and searches to plea bargaining and sentencing. Mass incarceration is now off-limits to challenges on the grounds of racial bias, much as its predecessors were in their time. The new racial caste system operates unimpeded by the 14th Amendment and federal civil rights legislation, laws designed to topple earlier systems of control. The Supreme Court's famous proclamation in 1857, "The black man has no rights which the white man is bound to respect," remains true to a significant degree today, so long as the black man has been labeled a felon.